Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Shout out to super producer Casey Pegram. Shout out to our producers, Andrew Howard and Max Williams. And in a really weird way, I guess, tangentially, shout out to Napoleon. Yes, I'm Napoleon. I'm Ben.
I'm Napoleon. No, that's not my name.
No, it was worth it.
Nah, I think it's always worth it. It's always worth a try. You know what I always think of whenever we cover Napoleon? I probably mentioned this before.
Is it Bill and Ted? Because I always think about when he was eating ice cream and trying to take other people's ice cream.
That sounds like something Napoleon would do. Now, there's a really cool Phoenix song called Napoleon Says. I don't understand the reference, but it's Napoleon says to take off your coat, take off your long johns too. Napoleon says to take off your coat, take off your long johns too. Riding in a trench coat. I don't know what any of that means. I think that's why I love Phoenix, because they're clearly, you know, not English as first language speakers, but they write all their song lyrics in English. And there's a fun, charming kind of Lost in Translation vibe, not only because they were also on the Lost in Translation soundtrack, but it is something that happens in the transition between French to English that I find very charming.
I think they do it on purpose. They seem You're like the nicest people. And I love seeing them live. And, you know, I'll admit, I was one of those kids who had some emo moments to some Phoenix songs, and I greatly appreciate them. But I do wonder, like, sometimes when you read the structure of the lyrics, you're thinking, like, did they just think, yeah, this will work.
You and I saw Phoenix together many years ago in the before times at the Shaky Knees Music Festival. That was a lot of fun.
And we're cheap folks, so we went because it was free.
It was free. That one time we got free festival tickets.
But today's episode, Noel, this is funny because this relates, it's weird how synchronous this became. This relates to a couple of things that are near and dear to our hearts and that we've covered recently, not just in this show, but in our other companion show, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. We did a whole episode about the Jersey Devil. No spoilers, but we figured out a pretty likely explanation for this cryptid. And then we had this throwaway fact in that show where, like, a lot of people saw the Jersey Devil. One of them was related to Napoleon Bonaparte. And it was one of those things, like, if you listen to that episode, which I think we did an okay job on, we sort of, like, threw that fact out there. We're like, there we go. And then we just never talked about it again because we had a bunch of stuff to do.
Yeah, it's true. And in this episode, I mean, this isn't about the Jersey Devil, but we're going to get to that section of Joseph Napoleon's life when he immigrated to the United States after serving as sort of a, you know, reluctant king under his brother's reign. Because, you know, you can't be Napoleon's brother and not get some kind of, like, juicy post, you know, as a result.
Yeah, that's the thing. We're talking about Napoleon's older brother, Joseph, and he's been described by historians as personality-wise almost the polar opposite of his buddy Napoleon. Joseph is like an idealist. He's mild-mannered and he's, quote, lacking in vigor. He's what a former president would have called low energy.
Old low energy Joseph.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if it's Joseph or not. I'm just going to do it because it seems like, you know, when French people have names that you would pronounce one way in English, they're usually pronounced differently. Like, again, singer of Phoenix. Look at it on paper. It's Thomas, but he goes by Thomas.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I'm going to stick with, you know what, I'll alternate between them. My arbitrary defense of that decision is going to be that he did immigrate to the States.
Fair.
So there we go. Yeah, he was like, it's funny because no matter how intimately aware of Napoleon's reign and rise to power as you might be, odds are a little bit lower that you would have heard too much about Joseph. He was a quiet dude. He liked literature, gardening, and I love this phrase. He liked entertaining. I love when people say entertaining. It's such a vague thing as a verb. Like if you see those House Hunter things and someone's like, my name is Marlon and I own a vintage toenail clipper shop. And then someone's like, yes, and my name's Sandy. I admire otters from afar. Our budget is $10 million. And whenever they go through a living room, you know, they're getting shown around the house. They have to have problems because it's House Hunters. They're like, I don't know if this is big enough. We love to entertain. Like, what is that?
Or another way, you see influencer types talk about that as their primary occupation is entertaining, you know, or hosting. I love to host, you know. Basically means you have a fancy house and you like to spend lots of money on fancy parties that you can then post videos about your fancy parties and your fancy friends. No shade. It's a way of living. But it is kind of funny when your whole reason for existing is to kind of flex on the internet, just sort of kind of what being an influencer is. Influencers out there, correct me if I'm wrong. Ben, I think I have a little bit of a clue as to how you might pronounce the J word, as in our hero's name.
I thought that's what you were looking up, because mm-hmm. I was like, no, my House Hunter joke was solid.
No, it's super solid. And did I not laugh?
No, we'll fix it in post.
We'll fix it in post. I laughed inside. My heart laughed and smiled at the same time, sweet. Which is very difficult to do for a heart since it doesn't have a mouth.
So what's the word? Is it Joseph?
Well, I just know that he was born Giuseppe Bonaparte. So I'm guessing that Joseph might have been the Americanization of Giuseppe.
Oh, yeah.
Giuseppe. So I'm gonna flip it. I'm going to go back to Joseph.
All right. Well, and then, you know, maybe his close friends called him Giuseppe. And he was like, only you can do that. You and my little brother. So it's funny because it seems like if we look at it, Noel, it seems like he would have been happy just living sort of a life of leisure, right?
Mm-hmm. He was born, again, Giuseppe Bonaparte in Corte, Corsica, on January 7th of 1768. And he was the oldest sibling of Charles and Letizia Bonaparte's 8 children, one of which, of course, was their second child, Napoleon, or as his buddies called him, Naps.
Naps.
Nappy.
Mm-hmm. The original Napster.
Little Nappy. No, nobody called him that. And that wasn't funny. I appreciate the laugh, though, Ben, and I will return the favor when you make a joke that doesn't land at some point later in our career. It's bound to happen, Ben. You're usually, your batting average is high, but you never know.
Likewise.
You never know. But he and Joseph were tight, right?
Yeah. Giuseppe and the Napster were a dynamic duo for sure, because they grew up together. They spent their early childhood together. And then they left Corsica in 1778 to go to school, and they traveled together. Joseph had been, this happened in a lot of families, he had been like singled out as the kid who had to be a priest. So he started studying.
There's always got to be one, I guess, right?
Yeah, often. So he started classical studies at one college, and Napoleon went to a military school in another city.
Mm-hmm. And Joseph didn't want to be a priest.
What?
I imagine that happens quite a lot too, where like, you know, in the pecking order, you got your military leader. Maybe there's one that gets to be a doctor, or like maybe there's one that's like the black sheep who's like, we're going to accept the fact that you're going to be a sculptor or something. And then, you know, maybe he just seemed like the most pious. I don't know what makes you suited in the eyes of your folks to be a priest, but they obviously saw the Lord in him, but he didn't see it in himself. He wanted to join his bro and be a military man.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it feels like, you know, there's always, you and I are both only children, so I always imagine there's a little bit of like sibling rivalry. You don't want your siblings to get like the cool stuff and you get stuck with the not so cool stuff. So maybe he felt, you know, a version of that. Like, why does my little brother get to go off on adventures and I have to be a priest? But that's the thing, a deathbed promise came into play. Charles Bonaparte was dying. He was ailing. It was not long for the world. And he made his son, Joseph, promise to give up any sliver of a thought or ambition of following a military career. And he said, instead, you need to return to Corsica and devote yourself to the family. And then when the elder Bonaparte passed away in 1785, that's when Joseph becomes head of the whole operation. He looks after the farm, the vineyard. He helps his mom support his younger siblings. And then he still is able to continue education. So in 1787, he goes to the University of Pisa, and a year later, he has a law degree. So So he's not a priest.
He's not a priest at all. He decided to follow the law instead of the Lord. And he then got a job in the French Corsican judicial system. And he and his brother continued to kind of, you know, be, there wasn't, I didn't get a real sense of sibling rivalry here, which is interesting when you consider the heights to which Napoleon rose. Mm-hmm. Joseph seemed fine with that all throughout the story. I just wanted to lead with that a little bit because he seemed like a pretty reasonable guy. And as we get into his time in America, that reasonable side really shines through.
Yeah, that's true. So because he has a law degree, he gets a job, right, working in the judicial system, and he and his brother do work together, as he said, and they want to advance the French revolutionary cause in Corsica, but then they get into a conflict with the leader of the Corsican nationalists, Pasquale Paoli, and that happened in 1793, so they hightail it to France. And now things take a change. Life takes us in crazy directions. And a family friend helps Joseph get a job as a commissary of the army in the south of France. So he actually does kind of work with the military.
Etymology question for you, Ben. I know this is a pet project of yours. Commissary is a position in the military like that, but it's also like what they call like the canteen where you eat your food. Any idea why that is? How those things are related?
Yeah, kind of. So it's been around since 1362 in English, and it meant one to whom special duty is entrusted by a higher power. So technically, you know, if you want to mess with your kids, if you have kids, then when you're on a road trip or something, make one of them like you are the commissary of the aux cord. You get to decide the music, but be careful because you can always be overthrown if I don't like Baby Shark.
Who doesn't like Baby Shark?
I don't know, man. I think it's an all right song in small doses. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's too much of an earworm, but I think you were able to get to avoid the Baby Shark thing, right? It came out after your daughter was
sort of. For her, it was more of a meme than something that she was actually into. And she's also got a baby sis. So her baby sister was a big fan. And there's actually this funny toy that you can get. It's like a baby shark that sings the song, but it sings it depending on how fast you pump its mouth. That sounded weird. What I mean is it's like a hand puppet and you move its mouth. And as you move it, it changes the speed of it. So if you move it really slow, it's like, Baby Shark, it sounds like a battery dying in a doll or something, you know?
Yeah. So commissary comes from Latin, comitere, and then it eventually evolves to person in charge. But as far as when it became specifically related to food and the storage of food, that may be a story for another day. But he's in there, right? He's in the military now. He's not a priest. And while he's staying in Marseille, he meets a daughter of a wealthy merchant. Her name is Marie-Julie Claret. And it's funny because there's a great article from ShannonSellin.com that's pretty blunt. And I think a little bit, I don't know if they're trying to be mean, but they say Julie was not physically attractive, but she was intelligent. And she basically had a great personality, and Joseph's mom liked her and also thought she would be a good match financially for her son. So they got married on August 1st, 1794.
Isn't it always the merchant's daughter? You know, that seems like such a trope, you know, married the merchant's daughter because you have to curry favor with the merchant. They're always very stern and want the best for their daughter. It is pretty funny that shady Shannon Sellin article that kind of negs this particular merchant's daughter. But it's true. They get married on August 1st, 1794. And that's when Napoleon began to really, you know, do well for himself. But so did Joseph in his own way.
Yeah. They were, for a while, they were in kind of like a rising tide carries all vessels situation. Mm-hmm. I believe he went with Napoleon on the Italian campaign. And then in 1797, he was elected as a Corsican deputy to the Council of 500. The Council of 500 is a lower house legislative body established by the French Constitution in 1795. It was called that because they have 500 delegates, and they were charged with initiating legislation for the upper house. The Council of Ancients would accept or reject the laws they worked on. So picture it a little bit like a House of Representatives almost. This is great for business. Eventually, he becomes the French ambassador to the court of Parma, and then he becomes the ambassador to Rome. And now he is wealthy. He is balling. He is not worried about money, Noel. He is, it's good to be Napoleon's brother at this moment in time.
Exactly. I love this brotherly love situation, you know, like you're used to seeing so much backstabbing and kind of backbiting, all the back things between brothers as they rise to prominence. But he seemed perfectly content to seeing his brother achieve all of this success because, you know, frankly, if he didn't have ambitions to be like the top dog, he certainly was benefiting from all this, right? Because he was also becoming incredibly wealthy. He bought a townhouse on the Rue de Rocher in Paris. Super producer Casey Pegram would be ashamed of my French pronunciation, but doing the best I can.
Oh, both of us.
I know. We always try. He also bought a chateau. Well, what makes the chateau a chateau? Is it just a style of house?
I don't know. Spelling mainly.
That must be it. And that little upside down little symbol over the A.
It's like a large country house.
Basically. It's an estate, right? It's basically like a vacation home. And he bought a lot of lands too. And I'm going to do my best here. Let's see. I get the gist of it. Let's just call it. I'm just going to pronounce it like a terrible American. Mortefontaine. And that was 19 miles north of the city.
And bonus nachos to you. Although that's
thank you, sir. Spanish. Bonus parte nachos.
There it is.
Et tu, Brute? Joseph and Julie had two daughters. They did have a third one, but unfortunately, she passed away shortly after birth. And their daughters were Zenaide, who was born on July 8th, 1801, and Charlotte, who was known as Lolotte. Lolotte. I guess that's just removing the char.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah.
It's adding an extra low. Mm-hmm. They were creative with their nicknames, those French. And she was born on October 31st of 1802. And Joseph began to really build out his assets, doing massive improvements on his estate, houses. And he really did enjoy that sweet, sweet country living. But he was also something of a gentleman, of course, and enjoyed the finer things in life, but also was strangely a simple man. It's a weird dichotomy with this guy, right? And he was described thusly by one of his biographers, an early 20th century biographer. He had an element of laziness in his character, a disposition to rest and quietly enjoy the good things he possessed in a dignified way. So he was lazy and dignified. In the debates of the 500, which was that council of 500 we talked about where he was a deputy, he took little part. And at the end of the term of membership, he did not seek re-election.
Yeah, that's the thing. He seemed like he was absolutely fine to just chill, just enjoy a life of relaxation and have some stress-free days. Napoleon had other plans. Napoleon very much felt that his brother needed to do more to help support the Bonaparte cause. So he said, look, initially I'm going to use you as a diplomat. Not necessarily because you're a great diplomat, but because I know you, older brother, and you're easier to control as we go back. So I would also say there's an element of trust there too. And Joseph wasn't super happy with this. The friction between the two men rose as Napoleon first became consul for life in 1802, and then just 2 years later, emperor in 1804. They clashed over who should be the successor, because Napoleon at that time did not have children. And Joseph said, and this is weird because it doesn't make a lot of sense for his character. Joseph said, look, I'm your older brother. You need to recognize me as your heir. And Napoleon wanted to recognize the oldest son of one of their other siblings, their younger brother, Louis. And so Napoleon started kind of trying to barter with his elder brother. And he was like, look, Joe, why don't just, I'll make you king of something if you just give up all claims to the French throne. I'll make you king of Lombardy. How about that?
Oh, yeah. It's weird, Ben. You're right about that. This being seeming out of character for the way historians kind of described this guy as like being content to like do his thing out of the public eye, right? But he clearly had some ambition, but I think maybe it was more he liked the money side of it. So he wanted to, you know, have that claim so he would inherit all of that wealth rather than like be the top dog, right? Or he care much about governing. Because again, we know with his career on the council, the 500, he didn't really care much about politics and he sort of phoned it in, right? So in 1806, Napoleon sent Joseph to kick out the dynasty that was in control of Naples, the Bourbon dynasty, and he became king. And Joseph was not super into the idea, as we said, nor was his wife. But in 1808, when Napoleon invaded Spain, he succeeded and offered Joseph the Spanish throne then, after his other brother, Louis, refused it. But he more specifically told Joseph to give up the throne of Naples and give it to their sister, Caroline, and her husband, Joaquim Murat, and then go to Spain, where he would take up his throne there. He was not into the idea, but he ultimately gave in and did what his brother asked. I mean, when Napoleon asks you to do something, brother or not, you got to give it some serious thought because you don't want to make an enemy of him. And as we know in history, brother or no, you can still become blood enemies.
True. The forces that were best suited to tangle with Napoleon were things like winter in Russia or rabbits, which is a true story. It's an earlier episode of ours. Check it out. Napoleon did get punked by a horde of rabbits. Yeah, this is not great real estate for French royalty because the Spanish had some stereotypes of the French at the time. Noel, they were like, the French are all atheists and they're foreigners. They don't deserve a break. We don't cut them slack. We don't give them a break. We give them no mercy. And they had a nickname for Joseph. Pepe Botellas, Joe Bottles, because apparently he really, really liked the sauce. That was the propaganda, but in fact, he was kind of a light drinker. Sort of like that propaganda about Napoleon being really short. It's somewhat of a smear campaign. They also had no problem hacking French soldiers to pieces. Joseph tries to make peace by having a lot of pretty moderate policies at the time, often in contradiction of Napoleon's orders from Paris. Napoleon divided Spain into six military districts. He allowed his marshals of those districts to exert pretty independent authority over the parts of the country they controlled. And then that undermined his brother's rule from the Spanish throne. So Joseph asked Napoleon, this is so funny, Joseph asked Napoleon, like, hey, can I quit? This job stinks. And Napoleon responds in 1812 by making Joseph commander-in-chief of all the French forces left in Spain. So congratulations, your face is on the most unpopular thing in the country right now. Ask me, I made you king. I made you king, the nerve.
Oh God, the absolute gall of it all. It's true. So on June 21st of 1813, Joseph decided to pick a fight with the Duke of Wellington, and a battle ensued at Vitoria, and the French lost. But that didn't stop Joseph entirely. He headed out for the frontier. So then after, you know, galloping across the frontiers, presumably, Joseph returned to his estate at Mortefontaine. And then Napoleon decided that Ferdinand VII, the Bourbon, you'll recall, dynasty family member, who he'd had kicked off of the throne to install Joseph, should return as the king of Spain, and that they should start to, you know, make nice between the two countries to help create the groundwork for a marriage of convenience between Ferdinand and Joseph's daughter, Zenaide, who was only 13 at the time. So maybe because of that, I know weirder things had happened, but he had his reasons. Surely Joseph did not like this idea at all, but was pressured, as he seems to have been kind of consistently throughout this story, and decided to give in.
Yeah, he acquiesced. and agreed for the Spanish crown to be transferred to the House of Bourbon with one important caveat. I still get to be called King Joseph. That's what he said. He never formally advocated. And luckily, the 13-year-old was spared having to have that child marriage for political purposes. Fast forward, spoiler alert, if you're listening to today's show, you probably already know what happened to Napoleon. He was defeated. He was forced into exile. Joseph found himself with a very unfortunate last name. So he fled. He hightailed it across the Atlantic to the United States under an assumed name. And get the chutzpah on this guy, Noel. He stole the crown jewels of Spain. Well, he probably didn't think he was stealing. He thought they were his, but he put them in a suitcase, literally, and took them with him to the States as he sailed aboard an American brig named the Commerce. It was twice inspected by the British, but his false papers, they worked. He was able to get through on forged papers. He left his wife and his daughters in Paris. They moved to Frankfurt and then later to Brussels. Of course, what do you do? First time? If this is a movie and you're traveling to the U.S. for the first time, you go to New York, right?
New York, New York. That's, you know, where so many immigrants to the United States, you know, found their kind of gateway into this new world type situation. So he went to New York sort of in shame a little bit. But once he got there, he kind of realized he liked it. He spent a little time in New York. And then moved to Philadelphia, where he took up residence at 260 South 9th Street, which became a very important hub for this huge influx of French expats coming into Philly. And he then, you know, settled in a larger estate house in Bordentown, New Jersey, which was just 25 miles northeast of Philly on the Delaware River. He called his estate Point Breeze.
Point Breeze. Sounds like an 80s film or sounds like a suburban community, right? I bought a timeshare in Point Breeze. So he's in suburban exile. He's quiet, but he got used to the good life. That's the thing. He may have still been dethroned, but he considered himself royalty. So he built a home worthy of MTV's Cribs. His vast mansion had a ginormous wine cellar, floor-to-ceiling mirrors, super fancy crystal chandeliers, marble fireplaces, grand staircases, you name it. Fun fact, with 8,000 books, his library held the largest collection of tomes in the country at the time. The Library of Congress only had 6,500. So he was like balling.
Yeah, he was tome rich. Ben, I know I've been doing this a lot in this episode, but what's the difference between a tome and a book? Tome's got to be a little longer, right? A book, it's like you got your pamphlet, you got your book, and then you got your tome? I don't know.
A tome is usually considered a very heavy book, and there's a little bit of a connotation of academic or like scholarship to mm-hmm. it, right?
Yeah, unless you get into making it a little bit witchy, and then it becomes a grimoire.
There we are. Yes.
But all, you know, maybe all grimoires are not tomes. All tomes are not grimoires, but all grimoires are tomes. What do you think?
I think that's pretty cool. It just depends on the length of a grimoire. If you're into grimoires, then I would hope you get a tome, you know, get some more occult bang for your buck. But you're right. Yeah. And you have to wonder what kind of books were in there. If you were to go to the mansion and meet Joseph at this time, you would walk through an elaborate landscape. 10 miles of carriage paths, rare non-native trees and plants, gazebos, gardens, even an artificial lake stocked with imported European swans. This guy is not hurting for money. And he loves to entertain.
He does love to entertain. It reminds me of like another callback to an early episode, the menageries of, what's his name? Pablo Escobar and the hippos, the imported hippos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's got that kind of vibe to it. I don't know, maybe a little more idyllic and a little less like safari park.
Less cocaine, probably, too.
Probably less cocaine, I would imagine. But thanks to Mental Floss, as always, for a great rundown of this very interesting man's life. We're about to get to the super fun part. But his home became this real kind of home base for a lot of his rich neighbors who would just come and hang. and look through his vast collection of tomes. And these were elites, obviously, very wealthy folks from Europe and America. And he would entertain dignitaries. Folks like John Quincy Adams would come visit Point Breeze. Daniel Webster, the Marquis de Lafayette of Hamilton the musical fame. Stephen Girard, who was a well-known French banker from Philadelphia, and was also apparently at the time the richest man in the United States.
Nice. Hanging out at the biggest library. That's a great collaboration of superlatives, isn't it? So there were rumors swirling around that Joseph may have been involved in several plots to rescue Napoleon from exile, but none of the charges ever stuck. He was also staying clear of other high-level intrigues, like the invasion of Texas by Charles Lallemand. It's weird because Joseph's nephew, Louis Napoleon, says that Joseph was offered the Mexican crown by a group of Mexican revolutionaries, and he turned them down, saying, "I've worn two crowns. I would not take a step to wear a third. Nothing can gratify me more than to see men who would not recognize my authority when I was at Madrid now come to seek me in exile, that I may be at their head. But I do not think that the throne you wish to raise again can make your happiness."
Ooh. And then the next part of this quote, Ben, really speaks to what we talked about at the top of the show, how much he loved the United States and our system of government. As imperfect as it might be, certainly to him, better than what he'd experienced in Europe.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because the last part of the quote is he says, "Every day that I pass in the hospitable land of the United States proves more clearly to me the excellence of republican institutions for America. Keep them then as a precious gift from heaven." So maybe his house parties had like started to sway his thinking, because he definitely was a reluctant king from the jump, right?
That's why I felt like it was really in character for him, you know? And it made sense that he would be super comfortable. Obviously, I mean, he's comfortable. He's living in the lap of luxury and isn't in danger of being, like, executed, you know, for, like, war crimes or whatever, you know, at the very least for being an enemy combatant. But his wife, though, didn't come with him to the States. He didn't see her for 25 years.
Yeah. Talk about a long-distance relationship. You know who he did see, though, during that 25 years?
I can imagine.
Yeah, that's right. His mistress, Annette Savage. He met her when she was 18 years old. She was, according to the pattern we've established, she was the daughter of some distinguished merchants. He ran into her while he was shopping for suspenders. She spoke French, match made in heaven. He was kind of known to be a philanderer, and his wife, Julie, was aware of this and tolerated his affairs. He had two children with Annette Savage, and then when one of them was killed or died tragically in the garden at a young age, Joseph later dispatched his mistress to Paris and paid her explicitly to never publish her memoirs.
Okay. Sort of like an NDA kind of situation?
You know what? Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, or maybe even like part of a prenup, but they weren't married though, were they? You can't be married if you're already married.
Yeah. So it was definitely
harder. It would have been harder to track that though back then, probably, right?
Oh, surely. Yeah, I think so. It would be harder. I mean, and how do bigamy laws work at that time on an international scale? But still, wasn't a good look. You know, a lot of locals were scandalized. So then another tragedy strikes. January 1820. His mansion, which we earlier established is pretty dope, catches on fire. It burns to the ground. His neighbors are able to help save some stuff, including his art collection. Newspapers of the day called the fire accidental, but there was gossip. There was a very weird rumor going around, and they said that the fire was actually the result of arson, because there was a local Russian immigrant who burned down his house because Napoleon invaded Russia.
And like we said, this was the second of a pair of tragedies. You'd mentioned, Ben, that his daughter Pauline was killed. And I just want to mention this because it was a new word that I learned, and I love sharing new words. She was killed by a falling ornamental vase, which had to have been very, very, very large and probably with poured concrete or some other heavy material. But it was called a jardinier, which would, you can picture those, like a giant planter that you would see on the grounds of an estate. Like so big you could plant like a small tree in one of them.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Bad way to go.
Yeah, an errant jardinier. How does that even happen? Maybe it wasn't loaded down with something and she pushed it to, I don't know. Anyway. But yeah, so despite those two tragedies, he was kind of unperturbed. I'm sure he was bummed, but he decided to take his neighbors up on their offers to help him because they loved him, right? And, you know, because it made sense. He was such a good host, such a good entertainer, and was very welcoming and open with his home and his beautiful library and all his tomes. So they were just really kind of kind to him and gave him solace. And he actually was so touched by it that he wrote down his feelings on the subject in a letter that he wrote to one of the town's magistrates. And it says, "All the furniture, statues, pictures, money, plate, gold, jewels, linen, books." And in short, I'm sorry, I'm only laughing because it's just like, he's listing like all the things. And in short, "Everything that was not consumed has been most scrupulously delivered into the hands of the people of my house in the night of the fire, and during the next day, they were brought to me by laboring men drawers in which I have found the proper quantity of pieces of money and metals of gold and valuable jewels, which might have been taken with impunity." So just to unpack, I mean, he's basically saying that like all of these neighbors, whatever their class and their staff, they could have looted the right. wreckage of his estate, but instead they like gathered up all this stuff from the wreckage for him and returned them to him, which to me, it just speaks to his character, doesn't it? I mean, they would if they were just kind of sponging off of him, then, you know, they would I would think that someone doing that would see a giant fire like this and be like, oh, well, the party's over. Better get whatever we can and fistfuls and just move on. But instead, they obviously cared about the man and not just the stuff.
Yeah, and this really got to him. And he said something toward the end where he said that really hits home. He says, "This event has proved to me how much the inhabitants of Bordentown appreciate the interest I've always felt for them." And Max, can we get a little like kind of inspirational music? Oh, there we go. "And shows that men in general are good when they have not been perverted in their youth by a bad education. Americans are, without contradiction, the most happy people I have known. Still more happy if they understand well their own happiness. I pray you not to doubt my sincere regard."
And then he signs it, "Joseph, Count of Servius." I don't know that superlative, Ben. Do you?
I did not before this episode, but I believe it's a commune in northern France. It's a community in northern France.
Yeah, that's one that didn't even come across our radar in the early research for this. But I mean, I'm surely a guy like that, he probably could have rattled off. You know, I mean, when people like that, they always have several titles. That was probably one of many. But this was printed in Bonaparte's Park and the Murats by Evan Morrison Woodward from 1879, a historical account. And he rebuilt his mansion and he stayed in New Jersey. And apparently it was bigger and better than ever.
That's right. Yeah, it's bigger, better than ever. He went back to business as usual, entertaining. "Please come and see my art gallery." And then he had lost a lot of stuff, but he became known as this font of European culture and artistic knowledge in early America because, you know, the U.S. had, and to a degree still has, a bit of a chip on its shoulder, right? About European culture being more sophisticated, being older, being fancier, etc. And so he was, for a lot of people, a connection point there. But we have one plot twist, a little bit X-Filesy. I almost feel bad for spoiling it at the top, but it is true. He is one of the people who is absolutely convinced that he had run into the Jersey Devil. As you know, in our other episode, we talked about the devil's origin story. According to legend, he's born around 1735. He's the 13th child of someone named Mother Leeds, and she said some sideways stuff, or the priest didn't bless the kid and the baby was born normally, but then morphed, at least in one part of the story, morphed and grew wings and hooves of fur and a tail, and then flew out the window or up the chimney. And now we have, like, and people of the area believed this story, by the way. So what happened? What happened with Joseph, man?
Yeah, well, so this is an area of New Jersey that fans of The Sopranos will be intimately familiar with, because it's one of the most beloved episodes of the show, called The Pine Barrens, which I'd never heard of until I saw that show. But it is apparently a place that's infamous because of its remoteness for hiding bodies, right? But it's also a place that's very easy to get lost in, as you will see if you watch this episode, Pauly Walnuts and Christopher Moltisanti do to great comedic effect. It's a standalone episode. And if you haven't seen the show, you can watch that episode having never seen the entire show, and it will delight you. It's all on its own. But it's crazy. If you look at lore and accounts of the Jersey Devil, it really kind of looks like a snaky-necked camel, horse, eagle thing, kind of. How would you describe the Jersey Devil, Ben?
Yeah, you can see a great picture of it. It looks like, it looks awkward. It doesn't look flight-worthy.
Out of balance, right?
Got kind of a T-Rex body. It's got these wings. It's got these hooves. It's got an awkward forward-leaning stance. And
very top-heavy.
Yeah, top-heavy. And if you look at some of the original sketches, it has a somewhat insouciant come-hither glare in its eyes.
Yeah? A little bit of a goofball. And I dare I say, not only insouciant, but perhaps Susian, because it really does look like the kind of like comical chimera, kind of like, you know, mishmash animal that you might see in a Dr. Seuss book. But Bonaparte claims to have been hunting alone, as he often did in these woods near his country estate, when he saw some really weird looking tracks that he attributed to maybe a horse or a donkey. We know what those look like, those kind of heart-shaped tracks with like the little notch at the top. But it appeared to, because he was schooled enough in tracking, that he could tell kind of where the weight would have been to make the type of tracks that he was seeing. So he believed that it was a creature that would have walked only on its hind legs. Well, I mean, obviously there would only be one set of tracks, right? Which is weird. That's not a thing that we know of. Tracks that look like that only walk on two legs, or animals that would make tracks like that only walk on two legs. And he decided, when he saw them ending abruptly, that this animal must also be able to fly or jump, you know, great heights. So he followed the tracks until the trail went cold. And then he was just fascinated, and he was just looking at them. And then he hears this sound from behind him, when he whips around. And what does he see?
He sees the devil. He sees this thing he had never witnessed or gazed upon before, with a long neck, wings, legs like a crane, with horse's hooves at the end. His stumpy little arms with paws, and a face that to him looked like either a horse or a camel. He froze. He panicked. And for a minute, neither he nor the creature moved. And the devil hissed, and according to the story, just flew away, and nobody was harmed. It's funny. It reminds me of camping. I don't know if I ever told you this, but one time when I was camping, I ran into a brown bear from a distance.
What?
Yeah, I was younger. I was, well, we're all friends here. I can say it. I walked over to a creek, and I was peeing in the creek. I'm in the middle of nowhere, and I thought, oh, this guy's like, no one's going to see me. It's fine. Doesn't matter. This is how life is in the woods. And while I am in the middle of this, I see some movement. Thankfully, on the other side of the creek, a little further down from me, I see this shape. It's moving. I'm thinking, oh no, what is, like, did one of the other Boy Scouts like come out or whatever? And dude, it was a bear. And you know, you're not supposed to stop peeing once you start. So I was just standing there kind of like peeing in front of this bear. And it was just looking at me. It was one of the most awkward moments of my life. You know, like, I was so shocked. My brain wasn't able to realize I should be scared. And I was just like, this is very embarrassing. And then I walked backwards.
Presumably with your business still. Okay, got it.
Yes, I was freaked out. And so although Joseph might sound silly right now, that's a real thing that happens. You freeze up. It's freaky. It's scary. So I have his back on that one. But here's the thing. And this is interesting. He was unaware of the legend of the Jersey Devil. he just thought he saw a weird American animal he'd never seen before. And he told his friends, you know, like, I saw the oddest thing. And then they said, oh, yeah, we've heard about that. And from that moment, for the rest of his life, whenever he was walking around the woods, he was like, I will find and kill this Jersey Devil.
This Jersey Devil. You know, it's true. And it honestly gives it a little more credence that the fact that he hadn't heard of the story.
Right.
I think. Because, you know, if you hear the tale like that, it would just really feed into your imagination and potentially, you know, your recollection of what you saw. Because you're like, oh, it had to be this thing of lore, you know. But still, as there often is with things like this, there's a pretty reasonable explanation as to what he might have saw that would have been very alien to him. And honestly, if everyone, which I think most of you do know, my particular phobia would have scared the ever-loving hell out of me. And that was a great horned owl, one of the most terrifying of all birds, because its neck, you know, can spin around like The Exorcist. It just has these deep, deep, deep soul-crushing eyes and a wingspan that can be like 5 feet wide. And also they can grow up to ridiculously large sizes. There are certain ones that have been known to get quite, quite large.
Yeah, yeah. And if you see one of these out in the wild and you are not familiar with the species, it's legitimately frightening. They also prey on snakes. So that could account for that hissing noise that Joseph heard. Some of these bigger owls are also strong enough to pick up puppies and kittens, and they've got a very characteristic screech that is blood-curdling if you're not expecting it. So that's his moment with the Jersey Devil. He became a cryptid hunter.
Didn't we talk about a screech in the Jersey Devil episode, and we traced it back to a crane, I believe, right? The particular type of crane that also has a pretty otherworldly screech, especially if there's like a group of them.
Right. Yeah, we had to put ourselves back in the perspective of people who lived at that time, because it sounded silly when we played the clip, but then we're like, now imagine 100 of them. So that's cool. He had a lot of careers in his life: King of Spain, cryptid hunter, society hub. He eventually went back to England, 1836, spent about a year there, 1837. And then he comes back to the U.S. for one last visit, stays for a few years. And then he goes back to England. He rents a house in Cavendish Square in London. In June of 1840, he has a stroke. It paralyzes the right side of his body. And so he moves back to Italy. And this is where he reunites with his wife, Julie, that, as we said, he hadn't seen in more than 2 decades, as well as his brother. He has another stroke in August of 1843. And the next year, July 28th, 1844, he passes away at the age of 77. His house is sold.
You know, and as relatively chill a guy as this story makes this dude out to be, it still does really point out the inequity in the gender systems of the time, or the patriarchal systems of the time. Not to get on a soapbox, but the fact that he, you know, had been gone for 25 years and then just kind of came back after having a stroke. And then I presume his wife just served as his caretaker, you know? It just seems very dismissive and diminishing of, you know, her role as a human being.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that's a tragedy all its own. His eldest grandson gets the house, gets Point Breeze. When Joseph passes away, he has these two huge packed auctions. And that's why even today, you'll find a lot of people in the U.S. who claim to have items that belonged once upon a time to Joseph Bonaparte, and a lot of local museums too.
Certainly possible. I mean, definitely in the local museums, but, you know, with a giant estate, can you imagine how much stuff? I mean, we talk, you know, we go to estate sales for fun. This would have been absolutely a mammoth estate sale. Probably some good deals to be had.
And there's one last note I think we can end on. It's poetic and it's kind of sweet. It's a movie moment. The brothers Bonaparte didn't get along all the time, but the love was for the homies was still there. There are two pieces of correspondence that really drive this home. And Noel, if you're up for it, I can do the first one, and maybe you can take us to the end of the episode with the very last word from Napoleon himself. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me, my friend.
All right. So Okay, so Joseph is telling Julie after the disaster in Spain, right? When he has to be king and everybody hates the French and hates a French king even more, he tells his wife, in spite of the disagreements that have existed between the emperor and myself, it is true to say, my dear, that he is still the man I love most in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like there was never any falling out between the two Bonaparte brothers, which is nice to hear. The story ultimately, I mean, aside from the, you know, look, I know so many people give us a hard time for like criticizing gender roles and things that were, oh, it was just of the time, you know, but I just wanted to point that out because the guy did seem like a pretty decent person, aside from the womanizing and, you know, abandoning his wife for 25 years. But it's not like he, yeah. 100%. But it's not like he left her destitute or anything. She was clearly provided for and lived a lovely life as well in her own right back there in Europe.
And we're going to give Napoleon the last word because he said something really sweet. It was a very nice thing for a despot to say.
He said, Joseph, though he has much talent and genius, is too good a man and too fond of amusement and literature to be a king. It is a nice thing, Ben, but it's also kind of a dig, a little bit.
Oh, very much. Very much.
but it's
still nice. Like you could tell they like each other, I think. And I like the idea that maybe someone is just like their inherent goodness makes them unqualified to be a king. And, you know, there might be something to that, but that is a story for another day. Joseph lived quite a life. He never caught the Jersey Devil, but he had adventures that many of us can only dream of. I really enjoyed this one, Noel. I know we went long, but it felt like one continuous narrative. What do you say?
I think it had to be, especially since we teased all the Jersey Devil stuff up front. It would have been really annoying to listeners if we had broken it right before the payoff. So honestly, you probably could have made it a two-parter, but we would have had to reframe the whole thing. And I'm completely happy with it as a one-parter. Yeah, I enjoyed this one too, Ben. It's a lesser known kind of side player in history and largely, you know, on his own, he might've made more waves, but since he was sort of in the shadow of his brother, who wasn't exactly as short as people say, he was kind of average height. Isn't that right, Ben?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I mentioned earlier with the, there was sort of this smear campaign, like the Spanish said, Joseph drank a lot. He didn't really drink that much. And that's where I was talking about, you know, Napoleon's height was widely misreported. It was just, again, pretty average for someone from where he's from in that time.
Well, huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, guest producer Max Williams, Alex Williams. They're kind of a Napoleon and Joseph kind of situation themselves. I'm not sure which is which, though, because they're both equally awesome. Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, soon to be here in the flesh once again, I surely hope. And Eves Jeffcoats.
Yes, yes. Hope everybody enjoyed our recent episode on Turpentine with the one and only Eves Jeffcoat. We also want to shout out our own Jersey Devil, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. the Quister. And, you know, the guy's so nice, we got to shout him out twice. The incomparable Gabe Lussier. Noel, it's been a long week, man. I don't know about you, but I am looking forward to kicking back and maybe I'll go hunt a cryptid. Maybe there's a Georgia devil I can find.
Ah, there surely must be many of them in the wilds of the low country. We're not low country. We're sort of mid country. I don't know.
The devil went down to Georgia.
He did do that. He was looking for a soul to steal. You know what? When I sing that song in my head, I often mash it up with Jerry Was a Race Car Driver by Primus. I go, the devil yeah, went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He said, I sure do love that big brown beaver. And that's different. That's known as Big Brown Beaver, but they all kind of mash together. But surely Les Claypool was into Devil Went Down to Georgia. No question about it.
And with that in mind, folks, we would, of course, love to hear your stories about bizarre crossover moments in history. Let us know what you think.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.